This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Lifetime Income Series. Today, we're going to do a couple special things. We're going to kind of blend what we're going to be talking about in the first part of the program with our guest later on. And what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about how to create a secure and prosperous retirement. Now, you probably just heard that and you think, sure, in this kind of environment. But, you know, if you take a look at what's going on in the country today, especially with the aging demographics, we have nearly 10,000 baby boomers that are retiring every single day. And it's going to be like that for over the next decade. We're also operating in an environment where we have 0% interest rates. And despite all the different interpretations with Ben up on Capitol Hill this week, there was one thing that he came away with, and that is the Fed is going to keep interest rates low at least until 2015. In addition to that, well, I bet a lot of us didn't expect we would go through two bear markets in stocks at the beginning of the last decade and once again towards the end of the decade, not to mention the fact that for the first time in half a century, we've seen housing prices fall for the first time. Now, what we're going to talk about, the best way to navigate markets like we have today, where you have government intervention, zero interest rates, volatile markets, the best way is to have a plan. And that plan becomes important because it really determines what your investment strategy is. And so that's going to be the focus today. A lot of times we see people put the cart before the horse. They're saying, okay, where can I get the best return? Oh, bonds are going up. I'll put all my money in bonds. No, gold's going up. I'll put all my money in gold. That's not the way to put together a secure and prosperous retirement account. The best way is have a plan, and the plan determines how you diversify your portfolio.
And I'm Kathleen Harris, and later on in the program today, we'll be talking about a different kind of plan, about a business plan or a business succession plan for your company with Jim's guest, Dick Gregerson from Janus Consulting, and he'll be talking about preparing for the sale of your company in case you're in that situation as you approach your retirement years.
Well, we've talked about a number of subjects, Kathleen, here on the program, but they're all sort of related to how to best prepare for retirement. That's what lifetime income is all about. And what has been dubbed in what we call today the new normal, an environment, as I mentioned earlier, where interest rates are low. In fact, they're close to zero. And we've had two severe bear markets. And just to demonstrate how low they are, it's hard to believe that less than 5 years ago, you could have got 5% on a two-year treasury bill. Today, you'd be lucky to get 0.25%. So that goes to show how much the investment environment has changed. Not to mention the fact that we've had two severe bear markets. And, you know, you take a look at what happened. Remember 2000? Everybody thought we were in the new economy. Well, turned out not to be so new after all. And we had a severe market pullback, likewise in 2007, where over a two-year period, it kind of looked like the whole financial system was coming to an end. And here we are now, 5 years later, with the stock market up 150%. So a lot of individuals that have either thought of planning for retirement or may be in retirement today don't have the assets they thought they would have. And quite honestly, how many people thought a couple of years ago we'd be looking at 0% interest rates, which is all of this, Kathleen, is making it very difficult for a lot of our retirees or a lot of those individuals who are saying, gosh, retirement is only 5 years away, and this isn't where I thought I'd be.
I think what's been going on, Jim, is that the investment environment we find ourselves in has really been making it very difficult for people to know how to invest to support their goals, whether those are retirement goals or other types of saving goals. So what we've been talking about on the show over the past several weeks is that there's a lot of people who they just don't know what to do. Maybe they're in cash, or they're overinvested in precious metals, which isn't producing any income for them. Or maybe they put all their money into bond funds, which have been reducing their income payouts over the last several years. The point is really that their investment portfolios aren't really lining up with their retirement goals anymore. And something I'm starting to see right now, Jim, is really a sense of panic for these people. They really just don't know what to do.
And that's why, Kathleen, and for those listening to this podcast, we place such a great emphasis on having a plan. I mean, if you're operating a business, you probably have a budget. If you work at a large corporation, not only do you have a budget, you have a capital expenditure plan. You have contingency plans if the business environment changes, as it did during a recession in 2007 and 2009. But more importantly, it really is the plan that should drive what you do with your investments. In other words, based on what your retirement goals are, what you think your expenses are going to be, how much you have in assets. This way, when you have a plan, then it gives meaning and purpose to your investment strategy. It keeps you centered. It avoids a lot of the emotional fears that have come into play with the vagaries of the financial markets. A good example, Kathleen, is this past week on Wednesday. Ben Bernanke was on Capitol Hill, and his first part of his testimony, he said, you know what? I'm not in a hurry to reduce quantitative easing. The markets rose. They were up to an all-time record. Well, give a few more congressmen asking them questions. Hey, we're starting to see unemployment come down. Things are improving. And he goes, yeah, by the way, you know, over the next couple FOMC meetings, we could see pulling back on QE. Well, we went from being up 100 points to being down over 100 points, almost a 250-point swing in just literally 10 or 15 minutes of questioning with the Fed chairman. And what you don't want to do is find yourself reacting to the markets. What you want to do is you want to have a plan that keeps you centered and says, you know what? Doesn't matter what Ben is saying today. My plan is working for me. It's helping me achieve my financial goals. It's providing me the income I need. I've got a plan. I have an estate plan, an investment plan, and you can feel more secure about your retirement.
Jim, that is so true. I think, you know, when you have an investment plan, it sort of helps you to ignore the emotion or overrides the emotion of investing and keeps you on track. What I've been seeing with the market being up over the past several years, double-digit gains, is that investors I talked to a few years ago who were all about safety, 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 and preserving their principal are now coming to me and saying, I want to be participating more in the market's upside. And that's pretty difficult because, again, that's a complete change from where they were at 2 years ago. Other things that we see happening right now is there's a lot of people who put a huge amount of money in their bullion, into bullion funds or into physical metal. And now they're stuck. They've got all this metal. Metal's been going through a huge downturn. They just don't know what to do with the metal. And so what we're seeing is that these people are essentially experiencing kind of a form of paralysis with their investments. They're just really stuck. So the reason why we're talking about this planning process and relating it to the investment choices you make is that, once again, having a plan eliminates some of these uncertainties and helps you stay focused and not get all wrapped up in the emotions of the markets and the emotions of investing, but that you have a plan, you know what the purpose of the plan is, and you know what the purpose of each type of investment is in the broader context of that plan.
And that's why, Kathleen, I want to talk about some of the steps of putting together a retirement plan. So some of you listening may say, okay, I agree with that. That makes sense. Having a plan of knowing what our assets are, knowing what our sources of income are going to be. And for those of us in the planning profession, putting together a retirement plan, there's a six-part process. One of them is you're going to have to find a planner, hopefully a certified financial planner, somebody that's gone through the planning process, knows all the important aspects of putting together a plan, all the vagaries of the tax laws, familiar with investments. So the first step is you got to find somebody that you can develop a relationship with, a financial planner, a broker, somebody that knows or has experience in the planning process. Now, once you've done that, the second part of the process, and I know it's probably something you don't want to hear, but you know what it's like. A little over a month ago, you just filed your tax return. And you know how difficult that is, putting all your deductions, finding out your W-2s, your income, and putting that all together so you can take it to your accountant, or if you're doing it yourself, you can file your income tax return. The second part of planning for retirement is gathering all this data. And then also actually sitting down and specifically talking about some retirement goals. If you're not retired, it might be, okay, I'm age 55. I want to be retired at age 66 when I'll be eligible for Social Security or my company pension will be available to me. And I would like to have X amount of income. And these are the things I would like to do when I'm retired. I'd like to travel. I'm going to play golf. I'm going to buy myself a motorhome. I'm going to get a sailboat. I'm going to attend bridge tournaments around the country. Whatever that is. But you're setting a goal and you're actually getting specific. You're saying, this is the income I want to have. This is the lifestyle I would like to have. And how do I make all of this happen? So the second step is gathering the data, putting together goals. And then the third step is actually analyzing and evaluate the financial status that you have. And that's a give and take process. There's more than one way to solve a problem. Whether it's one spouse may be more aggressive on investments, the other spouse may be more conservative, there may be health issues to address, there may be, I don't know, a move. Maybe it's downsizing, selling the house. But what you do is you analyze your choices and then try to take a look at, okay, option A, if I take this route, what does it mean? If I take option B and I do this, what does that mean? So step three is analyzing and evaluating your financial status. Four is developing a financial plan with the recommendations. All right, we're going to do this. In order to meet our basic monthly needs, this is what the investment portfolio is going to look like. This is how we're going to handle inflationary concerns and long-term care. And then you implement that plan, which is step five. And finally, Kathleen, step six, which we see a lot of times, we don't see the follow through. You have a plan, you implement it, but times change. Health issues may come up, investment markets change, family situations change. But the advantage of having a plan is the plan drives the investment process, and it's going to give meaning and purpose to the portfolio. For example, to provide predictable income to take care of your basic spending needs, you might have a laddered bond portfolio. You may need an immediate annuity if there's not enough income. And then you may even look at, depending on your age, of having joint annuities to take care of long-term care, which is increasingly becoming a major problem in the latter years of retirement because we're living longer. And then you might have stocks or a certain percentage in stocks. They're going to provide you with income, and that's going to be your inflation hedge. And you may even include some bullion as insurance against inflation or, let's say, a downturn in the purchasing power of the dollar. However, the plan balances your particular goals and needs with investments, so it creates a greater degree of certainty, and it's more predictable. And more importantly, you're less likely to react. So if we do have a correction in the stock market, well, you don't have all your eggs in the stock market. If the gold market corrects, as we've seen over the last couple months, you don't have 40 or 50 or 60% of your money in gold. Or if you have a need for income, you have some degree of certainty that you know that between your bonds, between your Social Security, or maybe you have one spouse or maybe both, if you're fortunate, you have a pension, you know on a monthly basis, you know exactly what your income is. So if the stock market goes up and down or gold goes down, it doesn't impact your lifestyle or your retirement.
And I think the other thing too, Jim, is not only does it not impact your quality of living in retirement, but I think it also just makes you feel like you're still in control of what's going on with your finances. Every piece of your portfolio that you have, every piece of your investments should have a purpose, should have a specific function in how you view it and your overall financial situation. I'll take an example here. Let's say these people who've been coming to me over the past 2 or 3 years who want to be more invested in the stock market. You know, a lot of these people we have invested in a portfolio that has some individual bonds and some stocks in it. So it's kind of a balanced portfolio. And what these people have been noticing is that because of the bond allocation in their portfolio, they've been seeing, you know, less of a high return than the rest of the market's been seeing. Well, that's kind of because bonds, you know, they aren't meant to perform like the stock market. They have a different function in your portfolio. They provide income and they're a stabilizing force. Typically, when the market corrects or goes down, your bonds tend to hold better value. So they tend to be more of a stabilizing force in the portfolio. So again, if you know what the purpose is for each different part of your portfolio, your group of investments, it'll help you be able to sort of, again, peel out the emotion from what you're doing and focus on the purpose of each different part of your investment strategy and your investment plan. So again, with the bonds, they keep you from panicking. If you see corrections coming, like the bear markets of 2000 to 2002 or 2007 to 2009, again, having a plan and a strategy keeps you from panicking. And again, if you know what each portion of your portfolio is supposed to do, if it's not going up with the market or down with the market, if you know that that's not its job, it helps you understand why it's doing what it's doing and why it's not doing what it's not doing. So again, having a plan also prevents you from really over-allocating into a specific asset class. And Jim, I want to get back to something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned about the need to actually go back and revisit the plan. So once the plan is in place, it's not written in stone. And in fact, it's healthy and good to go back and revisit it from time to time. So Jim, let's just say the markets change or your health situation changes, or maybe your family situation changes. There's a birth, there's a death, a divorce or something like that. What sort of steps should we go through to update the plan when those sorts of things happen?
Anytime, Kathleen, there's a major change, whether it's a change in health circumstances, changes in family, maybe you have kids that are going through tough times, maybe you have children that have gotten a divorce, you're supporting the kids. We've seen that happen. Health considerations, certainly. And then also just change in investment markets. Let's face it, if we take a look at the 80s and 90s, the 90s were all about stock investing. Everybody was going to get incredibly wealthy because we were in this new economy. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, 2001 and 2002, we got our first bear market and we found out the new economy wasn't so new after all. And then interest rates came down and it was off to the races again for the next 5 years. But this time we got a housing bubble and a credit crisis. So, you know, given those circumstances, the important thing, if you have a plan, you probably weren't affected as much as, let's say, if you had all your assets in one category, but you do want to update your plan for all of the above reasons you just mentioned. Change in markets, change in health, or just change in family circumstances. Because we know one thing that is certain, Kathleen, is change. The markets today are going to look much different today than they will 5 years from now. You know, quite honestly, if I would have told you 10 years ago, let's say you retired in the year 2000, we did your financial plan, you know, getting 7%, 8% income, that was no problem whatsoever. In fact, interest rates were, heck, you could get 5, 6, 7% on treasury bills back then. Today, you're lucky if you get 0.1%. And so that's just a good example of how things have changed over time. And had you been all in fixed income, let's say you were in a bond fund, imagine to your horror what you would have seen take place over the next decade as the Fed lowered interest rates following the 2000 bear market, raised them, and then Bernanke brought them down to zero again. So there are a number of reasons why you want to update your plan. Just like for health reasons, we all know once a year, it's a good idea to go get a physical. Even though you may be feeling good, everything's working out, that doesn't stop you. Your doctor wants to see you once a year just as a preventative checkup. And it's a good idea to do that with your retirement plan as well.
I think probably the best thing to do at this point, Jim, is to walk our listeners through an example of some clients that we have. Our clients, John and Barbara Jackson, have been with us since 1995. And so since they've been with us, their financial plan and their investment strategy we've implemented for them has changed several times over the years. And this is healthy. Every time that there was a significant event in their life, whether it was retirement or selling their business, John passed away about 3 years ago, and all these different events in their lives led to different changes in their plans, different strategies with their assets and with their investments. John's widow came into the office a few months ago to update her plan because she's at a point in her life where she feels like it's time to make that revisitation of the plan. So, Jim, since you've been around with this client since 1995, would you mind walking our listeners through some of the changes that were made to their family's overall plan since they've been with us?
They became a client back in 1995, and John had a packaging business at the time. And so he came in, attended one of the seminars. I used to give seminars locally back then. And he and his wife, Barbara, attended a seminar I gave, and it was about putting together retirement plans. And in the back of John's mind, he was thinking, you know, someday, because of the contacts he had with his business, the people he dealt with, that someday in the back of his mind, his business was going to sell. So initially, they came in to put together a plan, and mainly it was managing their pension investments and also their personal investments. But in addition to that, we put in place an estate plan. And that was 1995. So we started out with an investment plan. And John basically said, you know, someday this business is going to sell. I get offers every year from the folks I deal with that, you know, they'd like to buy the business. I'm not ready to step down yet. Another thing that we did too, in addition to his estate plan, in talking with the estate planning attorney, who also is a tax attorney, they set up John's business as a C corporation, because John brought up the fact that because so much of his estate was the value of his business, he mentioned that someday he would probably sell the business because he would want to retire, and he was getting offers on the business. So we set up John's business as a C corporation. In 1999, one of John's clients that he dealt with in the packaging business made him a very attractive offer. And that offer came in the form of a purchase price in exchanging stock. Now, this gets into some of the minutiae of tax planning, but if you have a C corporation, most public companies listed on the stock exchange are a C corp. So when you see, I don't know, IBM buy another company in stock, they exchange stock, and there is no tax consequences of that transaction. And that's what took place in 1999. John sold his business to a public company, a company that his business dealt with. In exchange for his stock, he got stock in this new company. Now, we had a considerable amount of assets wrapped up in one company stock. He did not want to keep it all invested in that stock. And also, he was looking at tax consequences here in California, plus federal taxes, where almost a third of the stock would be taken in terms of capital gains, because the basis of his business was very, very low. So what we did is we set up something called the Charitable Remainder Trust, where we transferred the assets to a charitable remainder trust. And once they were transferred to the charitable remainder trust, first of all, he got a tax deduction for doing it, which helped lower his taxes for the year. And the second thing is we were able to sell the stock gradually in the charitable trust without any tax consequences. And as a result, both John and his wife Barbara were drawing on a nice level of income. So that was 1999. And then in 2010, Kathleen, John passed away.
That was really hard. He was a good client. It was hard to see him go.
Yeah, and he was one of the funnest guys. He was just a great guy to be around. And there were a couple of things that came into play. In the charitable trust, there were three charities that were going to be the beneficiary. And one of them was the alma mater of Barbara's college. And there was also a request that John had that he wanted to make a gift. So there was close to $500,000 that was distributed to each of his three children. He had two daughters and one son. And the purpose of that, because John was 5 or 6 years older than Barbara, it was assumed that John would be the first to pass on. And there were two things that wanted to be done. First of all, the assets in the charitable trust had grown to a level. We had more than doubled the assets of the trust. And so on John's passing, Barbara wanted to take a distribution from the charitable trust and give it to her college all at once. And so that college got one third of the charitable trust because, well, she went to a reunion, she talked to people at the college, and she wanted to see the benefit of that done in her lifetime rather than waiting. Usually with a charitable trust, once the last spouse passes on, it usually goes directly to the charity. She wanted to see the benefit of that during her lifetime. That was the first thing that we did. The second thing that we did is we made distributions to each one of the children. So that was done in 2010 when John passed on. In 2012, the remaining properties that they had, Barbara wanted to get liquid. And also, the real estate market was not as good as it used to be, but she basically wanted to get liquid. The people that were renting wanted to buy the property from her. And so the last remaining commercial properties that they own were sold and were put into a tax-free bond portfolio because now there was a considerable amount of more income that was going to come in. Plus, the money that was being thrown off by the charitable remainder trust was increasing because the value of the trust was increasing. And then another thing that was happening as well is that she wanted to prepare herself to go into an adult retirement home. And so that was what we did in 2012. A month ago, she came in and she was very concerned. The money that had been given to her three children, things did not go well, Kathleen, as you know, and there were a lot of mistakes made. You had a son-in-law that came in and did some things that she didn't approve of. The money was mismanaged. So when she came in, she wanted to put her affairs in order. She's now in a retirement home. She's still in good health, still has an active mind, plays bridge, plays in bridge tournaments. But more importantly, she came in to talk about how to take care of this substantial sum of money that would pass on to her three children when she passed on, because it had not gone very well in terms of John's request at his passing would be that a small distribution be made with Barbara watching how the kids handled it. It was sort of like a test. Well, that test, the kids did not pass. So about a month ago, she came in, and it was good that she did come in because when the distribution was made from the charitable trust, a one-third of it going to her alma mater, that had not been changed in the trust document. So her charitable trust needed to be changed to take into effect that the one charity had already received the funds that it was entitled to. The second thing is she wanted to set up a corporate trustee that would hold the assets in trust for her three children because they had proven they weren't capable of managing the money in a way that her husband and she herself thought they should be managed. And quite honestly, had been mismanaged. So she also wanted to protect her children from, let's say, a son-in-law. And so what happened is we are now getting her in touch with her attorney. We're updating the charitable trust. And we're also going to have something, I think, for those of you listening to this, very, very important for a surviving spouse. We're going to have a 3-page document that basically describes the trusts that are in place. We have a marital trust, what we call the B trust, which was her husband who passed away in 2010. The balance is going to be in the A trust, which was Barbara's portion of the estate. And then also we have a charitable remainder trust. And it spells in this document, in terms of 2 or 3 simple pages, her children will know exactly where the money is, what the trusts are, who the beneficiaries are, and now we're going to bring in a corporate trustee because she's worried that, you know, some point down the line as she gets older, she says, I'm not going to be as sharp as I am now, and I want this in with my estate planning documents. So if something ever happened to me, I become incapacitated. That's another reason that we also want this corporate trustee because there's a considerable amount of money here, Kathleen. The trustee would come into play here and manage Barbara's assets or take over should she develop, let's say, Alzheimer's or dementia. Now, her mother lived well into her 90s, and Barbara's only 85, so she's got a long way, and you've seen her. I mean, I wish I looked that good at 75, so.
Oh, she looks amazing.
Yeah, so here was a plan that started out initially with John and Barbara in 1995 when John was running his business, putting together a tax plan, estate plan, and investment plan. The business was sold. We set up a charitable trust. Then with John's passing, we made charitable distributions and some distributions to the children, sort of a test to say, all right, we have a large estate. Here's some money. Let's see what you do with it and see if you pass the test, if you're capable of managing the large sum of money that you're going to come into when Barbara finally passes away. And unfortunately, that test wasn't passed. And so now, also, as well as in 2012, Barbara's moved to decide to go into adult living retirement home. And more recently, now we're updating the estate plan to update the charitable trust, as well as to account for that distribution, as well as bringing a corporate trustee to take care of Barbara should something happen to Barbara or she become incapacitated. But more importantly now, to take care of the three children to make sure that the money's going to be there and it won't be mismanaged as it has when the distributions were made in 2010. So here is a process over, what, almost 18 years now, how this plan has evolved and changed with time as a result of changes in the markets, change in the business, the sale of a business, change of the tax laws, and also changes in family circumstances in terms of the children's ability to manage a large sum of money.
I think what this example really demonstrates, Jim, is two very important points that we've been trying to hit home in this particular segment of our NewsHour program, is that number one, especially right now, more than ever, given how difficult and complicated the investment environment is, having a plan is absolutely critical, number one. And number two, what this plan that we did with the Jacksons demonstrates is that being flexible and being able to revisit the plan, especially when important changes take place with your family's finances or family makeup, that you need to revisit the plan and change the plan. And I think that their example especially is really great for our listeners because it ties in perfectly with your interview with Dick Gregerson, who specializes in helping people with mergers and acquisitions. And a lot of our clients and listeners out there are small business owners. And so I think they'll find it very useful to hear from Dick Gregerson about preparing their businesses for buyout. And also, and this ties in with the overall estate planning, is how to set up your business with a good succession plan, which is something that I think every small business owner needs to consider. Let's just say something happens. What are the next steps for the business and for your family? And so, Jim, I know that you and Dick talked about succession planning, which I think is an important part of this overall financial strategy for folks.
Yeah, I think this will blend in very well with what we're just talking about, because there are a lot of small businesses out there. And in this case, you know, John and Barbara Jackson, they had a business, a very successful business. And fortunately, with planning, we set it up in a way that worked tax efficiently for both John and Barbara. And also later on in their retirement plan for tax advantages and also for income. So that's coming up right after this. When you think about the American economy, it's made up mainly of small businesses, single individuals that went off on their own and started a business, partnerships. It's not big corporations. Yes, they're large companies listed on the stock exchange, but that's not the vast majority of businesses in this country. One of the problems, if you own your own business, what happens when it's time to cash out or somebody makes you an offer? How do you exit a business? What do you do? How do you structure it that it is favorable from a tax point of view and from an equity point of view? Joining us on the program is Dick Gregerson. He's president of Janus Associates and Janus Consulting. Dick, as I mentioned in that intro, when you take a look at America, you think of our vast economy, you think of the big corporations like Google, Microsoft, Apple. But the vast majority of companies or businesses in this country are single proprietors, they're partnerships, small businesses. Let's talk about what happens if you own one of these type of businesses. Let's say you're a sole practitioner or a partner, and all of a sudden it comes time to cash out or somebody presents a very lucrative offer to you. Let's talk about what you should do and how to prepare for that event.
Oh, very good. Yeah, you're right. There are millions of businesses like that in the United States, and particularly in the California area, we have a higher level of entrepreneurship, and so there are many more companies that are like that. The process of selling a company actually requires a different mindset on the part of the business owner. Every business owner out there has a successful business. They have customers and clients to trust them. They value their products and services, they have a reputation and expertise, they've survived startup, and they enjoy a level of success and income. But just because they are a successful business doesn't mean that they're going to find a buyer. In fact, the SBA says that of the millions of baby boomer businesses that will be looking for buyers, that 80% of those owners will be disappointed. And the reason for that is a lack of preparation on the part of those business owners. There are plenty of good businesses that, or even mediocre businesses that sell every day, and there are great businesses that go begging. And we believe that the difference in that, in our experience, has to do with changing your mindset from running the business to serve your customers' needs and in a manner that's consistent with your management style. to running your business so that you're making it more attractive for buyers. In essence, you're changing from your day-to-day customer to who is the potential buyer.
You know, you mentioned that the real key is a lack of preparation, and it requires a different mindset. Let's talk about that mindset. What changes? Let's say that, okay, I'm running a business. I'm very successful at what I'm doing. I'm generating a good income, good cash flow. I have good customers. You know, I'm really attractive for somebody to, let's say, make an offer. What do I need to do to change? Let's say that I'm getting, you know, older, and I'm saying, you know what, it'd be nice to maybe just head off to the golf course and do a little traveling. I want to exit. What do I do to change? Let's talk about the mindset first, because I have seen this with business owners where, you know, even when they sell their business for a large amount of money, they get a little bit paranoid because they no longer have an income and they're dependent on, let's say, their investments in the investment markets, which let's say they weren't as comfortable with when they were running their own business, which was something they knew, they understood, and it had a predictable source of income. So let's talk about mindset. What needs to change there?
Well, you know, most business owners fall into, let's face it, a bit of a rut. I mean, starting the business up is fraught with danger. There are periods of going through difficult times where it's tough to make payroll. And what we found with many of our clients is that there are things that they have chosen not to do because they haven't wanted to take the risk. They might be launching a new product or selling to a certain customer that's given them a hard time in the past, or any number of different innovations that they could be doing with their business that they haven't yet tapped. We had a client a few years ago that was in the automotive parts industry, and they came in and said, you know, the two owners were taking about $1 million a year out of the company, and they asked us to appraise the company, and they had a couple $1 million of debt. We said, well, you're probably clear $4 million. And they said, well, that's not enough. We're 55 years old. If we sold it today, we'd be broke in 3 or 4 years. And so we said, well, then what you need to do is to think about what strategies you haven't pursued. And they looked at opening up manufacturing and assembly in Mexico or in China or acquiring a company, and we helped them evaluate each one of those. And they decided that maybe they wanted to try their hand at acquiring a company. But every time we called them, they were too busy working on some projects. So they were out in the Inland Empire. We drove out from Pasadena to find out what it was they were up to. And they had come up with a new idea as to how to implement flexible robotics in their manufacturing. And we said, well, forget about all this other stuff. Why don't you implement that? And the long and the short of it was that 3 years later, we sold them for $18 million. So I think that the way for an owner to feel more comfortable about that, what's going on out in the investment world, is to first maximize the value of their company. This is not an unusual phenomenon. During the 1980s, I was part of a two-person team that did a series of 7 acquisitions in the automotive aftermarket, and we didn't really come up with any brilliant new ideas. It's just that each time we bought a company, we asked the employees and the owner, what is it that you haven't done? What would you do if you were betting with other people's money? And on average, every one of the businesses we bought doubled in sales and tripled in income by implementing the lowest hanging fruit of those particular items inside a 5-year period. So part of the mindset that you need to change is, what are the things that I haven't done with the business, recognizing that the buyer is not going to pay you for something that you weren't willing to do yourself. And many business owners will market their company and say, boy, there's all this untapped potential in my business. And you know what? The problem is that none of the buyers are going to pay for that, or very few of them will. And now, why is that? Well, first of all, you got to think about who the buyer is. And the buyer for most of these companies, over 50% of the cases, have never been in your particular industry, never worked in it. They're either private equity funds that don't have any particular expertise in one way or the other, or they're individuals who have never participated in it. Even if they're an operating company, often they'll be acquiring you because you're a new market for them. So as a result of that, you're dealing with buyers that are somewhat ignorant of what it is that's going on with your business. And all the buyers, whether they're ignorant or savvy, are going to be a little bit suspicious about your company and why you're selling it, and is there something that's going on there that they don't know about? And that's where the preparation comes in one of the ways in which preparation comes in addition to increasing the value, you need to have a credible company that you're putting on the block. And that means you need to do a review of your contracts and your legal kinds of items and make sure that those are up to snuff. You should consult with your tax advisors and investment advisors as to whether or not you have the right planning for those investments going forward, getting into trust and those kinds of things that defer taxes. You need to go through your operations and figure out where you're making money and where you're losing money and be able to knowledgeably talk about it and document that. And you need to, for most of these guys, you need to upgrade your accounting so that there's some third party that's taking a look at it and says that what your financial system is saying your earnings are in fact what they are. All of those things are required because you're dealing with a suspicious and potentially somewhat uneducated buyer. And we always say that there's really only one thing that counts in mergers and acquisitions, and that's credibility. Businesses are made up of people and processes and technologies, but for most of these businesses, the main concern and the main area of potential failure for buyers is that it isn't going to operate as well under their ownership as it has under the original founder's ownership.
So, Dick, one of the things that you're saying there, change in mindset. Let's say I have a very successful business. Let's say that I have, in this case, like the example you gave, I have an auto parts business. You know, we're generating good money, good cash flow. But one of the ways that I could make it more attractive is, let's say I duplicate it and take and, let's say, open up another store somewhere and make money, because I would think, you know, maybe I don't want to do that because it's going to take more time. It's going to take more effort. It may take some capital that I'm pulling out of the business in spending versus, let's say, putting it back into the business by opening up another store. But what you're doing, if I understand you correctly, you're demonstrating the success of your business can be duplicated. So by opening up another operation, if that generates the same level of cash and income, you're demonstrating to a potential buyer that you have a franchise here that can be duplicated.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, one of the hardest kinds of businesses to sell at a premium price are those that are stores and retail establishments, restaurants, those kinds of things that are locked in on a geographic basis. And yet, there are plenty of examples, say, Bristol Farms, for instance, which one of the fellows that worked here who passed away, did a wonderful job of when they opened up their second store. They put together a plan for how to increase into 24 stores and wound up selling the company for millions of dollars more than anyone would have anticipated. But they did exactly what you said. They proved out that it would work in other markets. And it also showed a growth curve in the business, so that if you're saying to the buyer, if you invest in this and you open up new locations, they will be successful, and at the end of the day, you're going to wind up with a generous return on your investment in buying my company. But you need to prove out that first location and then prove out that it works in a second location as well.
So you've got what you're saying there is if you have a good business, you have to think of ways that could add value, ways that could bring in extra income, ways that could expand it. Because I suspect somebody buying your business is going to say, look, I'm going to have to pay you to buy this business. But the upside potential is if I can make that business grow, which I don't have to pay you for, or you have demonstrated that you have a franchise here that I can duplicate in other locations, other states, or it's a product that I could take to another level of sales. Putting that aside, let's assume that you've done all these things. Your business is generating a lot of good income, but you want to step away, or for that matter, all of a sudden, out of the blue, unexpectedly, somebody approaches you and says, hey, we have a guy that is, or a firm that's interested in buying your business. Let's talk about exiting the business. What are the best ways to do that? Because there's all kinds of tax implications. For example, depending on how you've set up your company, whether it's a C-Corp, S-Corp, In other words, if I had a bigger company that wanted to buy me for their stock, and assuming that their stock was attractive, let's say a public company, I could take their stock and avoid paying taxes. So let's talk about exiting the business and selling it, what you need to do.
Well, there are two aspects to that sales question. One is that, like everything in life, where there's competition, you wind up with a better result. And what many business owners do is they'll wind up getting an offer from somebody, and someone will say, yeah, that's about what things are going for in our industry. And they'll say, okay, we'll go ahead and sell on that basis. We had a client that owned 90 Jiffy Lube stores, and he was offered $38 million for the business by a competitor out of the blue, which was about what each individual store would have sold for on a combined basis, about $700,000 a store. We wound up putting it into a competitive process, and we wound up selling those same 91 stores to the same buyer for $62 million.
How much?
$62 million.
Versus 38?
Yes.
And wow.
So the difference in going out and market testing the business can make a substantial difference, somewhere between 20% and 100%. A lot of people will tell you, you know, you should sell for average, whatever the industry average is. But with a properly conceived sales strategy, you can do much better. And I dare say that in our 15-year history here at Janus, because of the kind of marketing expertise that can be brought to these things, there's no reason why you should be selling for an average price.
So part of the process is a competitive process. So, you know, somebody comes and gives you an offer and say, hey, businesses of your type are selling for X times sales or X times cash flow, whatever the metric is used in the business. If you can show that you have maybe a more competitive advantage or you shop, you can realize more money. So that's number one, that's more bucks for the owner.
Right.
What about structuring the sale? Because we live in an environment today, as you know, Dick, that here in California, we have high tax rates and we now have high federal tax rates. So what about structuring the sale?
If you're a C Corp, we always take the approach of trying to sell the stock of the company so you don't have to suffer with double taxation, but first inside the company and then when you distribute the dividends back out. With S corporations, whether you sell the stock or whether you sell the assets, there's not nearly so great a difference. But the real tax savings that you can achieve comes about from setting up a proper succession strategy or estate plan that shelters and defers some of those taxes by putting them into appropriate trusts and so on that can be used to defer that. Or, as you mentioned, the ability to receive stock as part of the compensation under certain circumstances can also defer that, those taxes.
Is there time, for example, let's say that I have a sole proprietorship, and I just say I was an entrepreneur, I started my business, and for whatever reason I remained that way, or maybe, you know, I just didn't do any planning. I was more concerned about, you know, the business itself. Maybe it was a partnership with another individual.
Mm-hmm.
Is there time in a sale, legally, with tax law, that I could say to myself, okay, we got an offer here. I get together with my tax attorneys, and they say, you know what? If you could set up a C corporation and sell it or convert to a C corporation, do you have time under those circumstances, Dick, to set up yourself in the most favorable tax light, number one? And number two, do the buyers also understand that as well? In other words, the buyer says, boy, if I can make this more favorable to the seller from a tax point of view, it's more likely the sale can go through.
Well, we're not tax experts, but what we understand is that it generally takes several years for that structure to be cured enough so that the basis for the change meets the tax requirements, which are that it was done for some good business reason rather than just as a tax avoidance kind of thing. So this is one of those areas where whether you're thinking about selling your company in a couple of years or in a decade, that it's well worth the investment of getting good advice as to how that company should be structured. But in the event where someone comes and offers you, you know, a great price and you decide that, you know, this is the time to sell, there are ways of structuring the businesses so that either you're selling the stock of the business or the assets of the business, that will reduce the level of taxation that you have on those, even without that upfront planning. But certainly, investing in that planning years in advance of doing things is favorable. But the tax issue is clearly a very important part and has become a lot more important with the unfortunate rise in our taxes recently. But the other thing to bear in mind is that often taking a passive position, particularly in a marketplace where 80% of the owners may not find buyers. And just as a sort of a footnote, in 2005, of those companies that had less than 10 employees, about 1 in 7 that were put on the market in 2005 found buyers. The companies that had between 10 employees and 500 employees, 1 in 3 of those that were put on the market in 2005 found buyers. So it's taking a passive position will probably wind up in a situation where you are not selling the company in an optimal manner. I had a discussion with a company in Northern California that's in the dental camera business, where they these high-resolution cameras that they shine in your mouth and show you how you need to spend a couple hundred dollars more with the dentist. And I asked the fellow, who was nearing 60, well, what are your plans for selling the company? So I'm going to run it for another 5 years, and I'm going to sell it. And I said, okay, well, how many competitors do you have? He said, oh, we have the best camera. Nobody is as good as us. And we said, well, yeah, but how many other people are selling similar products? So there are about a dozen. Said, well, how many consolidators are out there in the dental business? He says, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5? I said, so how many of the dozen competitors are going to find a buyer? 4 or 5? Yeah, that's about right. So that part of that change in your mindset is that you need to understand that it's a crowded field out there. There are a lot of baby boomers that own businesses. There are not nearly so many people in the next generation, and they don't have nearly so much money as the baby boomers have. And so this part of this change in mindset has to do with evaluating the market the way any business person would. There's a greater supply of companies for sale than there is demand to buy them. And that the people that distinguish their business in some way, that show unusual growth, that take the steps to prove out their business models and show an expansion, ones who take care of their operating problems and eliminate those items that aren't making money and emphasize those items that have good accounting, those are the companies, once they are properly marketed, will find buyers. But taking a passive position, hoping that when you get to be 65, that somebody's going to buy the company and that you'll get a premium price for it, just isn't recognizing the realities of the current market that we're in.
You know, you bring up some very important points. Number one is the mindset. And when you talk about that mindset, you mentioned there, Dick, talking about doing some things that would make your company more attractive to a potential buyer. It's demonstrating that you have a very successful business model, but also at the same time, thinking of how your company is structured so that you never know. I mean, obviously, if you have a profitable business, everybody loves to invest in profitable businesses. I mean, just look at Apple.
Yep.
It's also thinking ahead of how you want to structure your company, and especially if you become successful in the business, because that also can lead to more favorable tax treatment on the back end. And I would say another one that we see, Dick, what happens with lack of a succession plan? Let's say dad started the business, but he doesn't have any children that are either, number one, qualified to run the business, two, don't have an interest in running the business, and let's say three, God forbid, something happens to dad prematurely. So there's a number of issues here of why you want to demonstrate success, but also have a structure and a succession plan should the unexpected happen.
That's absolutely right. And unfortunately, there are many instances of spouses that the business owner dies and the spouse who isn't really part of the business now has this company that they're trying to sort out and get sold. And there are a number of things that you can do to help protect against that. You can buy insurance policies on yourself so the company, which may be your biggest asset, has the resources to continue to move forward while your spouse finds someone to help run the company. Another strategy that people use is to think through where the business is at, and then go out and find a, if the company has sufficient size, go out and find a private equity firm to buy out somewhere between 60 and 80% of your company to help you implement that. And so that's a middle point for many savvy business owners, so that they're able to increase the size of their business by using other people's money and get their safe money off the table by having sold 80% of the business. And what many of them find is that by implementing these actions, it might be making an acquisition, rolling out new product lines, buying more efficient equipment, whatever, that they get almost as much for the 20% that they hold that for 3 to 5 years until the business plan is executed as they got on the initial 80%. And so that can be a very attractive alternative, particularly for someone who doesn't have family members that they feel are either capable of doing it or just don't have family members that are interested in going into dad's business.
So as we conclude here, Dick, it sounds like, number one, if you are an owner or a partner in a very successful business, two things you should be thinking about. Number one, changing your mindset of, even though you may not be interested in selling the business, thinking of your business as something that could be sold to somebody. So what would make it attractive as a buyer? Because you don't know. Something could happen to you physically. You could pass away prematurely, or you could be in an issue where health reasons you want to retire. And secondly, if you are successful, think of how to best structure your business so if a sale does present itself to you, or you reach an age where you say, you know, I'm 65 now, you know, I'm getting a little tired of going to work, I'd like to play more golf or do more travel, you've set yourself in a position in advance that it's more favorable to you from a tax point of view. So it sounds to me, Dick, it goes beyond just being successful at what you're doing. You need to have a plan. You need to have a plan, whether you sell the business or not, but have a plan that can make the business attractive. And number two, if it does end up in a sale, you come out from a tax point of view in a much better situation. Would that pretty much sum it up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's going through the process of getting your company ready for sale and doing the proper planning up front can make a huge difference in your lifestyle for decades after you sell it. So it's not something that people want to think about because their businesses, they're so emotionally tied to their business. You socialize with your customers and your suppliers, and your employees are often your friends. And so people don't want to think about that ending. But those people that can have a clear eye to viewing their business not as their life, but as a product that needs to find a buyer who's willing to pay a premium price, that's the kind of mindset that's going to make you into a winner.
Well, listen, Dick, as we close, if any of our listeners would like to contact you, because we do have a lot of business people that listen to the show, how could they do so, please?
You can either email us at janascorp.com, JANASCORP.com, or call us at 626-432-7000.
We've been listening and talking with Dick Gregerson. He's president of Janus Associates on planning for a business. Dick, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. A lot of great, valuable information that I think is often overlooked with entrepreneurs. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, that completes this week's Lifetime Income. We were talking on this week's show all about planning, and you heard there from Dick Gregerson the importance, especially for a lot of small businesses, and it sort of dovetails what we talked about in terms of those getting ready for retirement. You need to start with a plan, because that plan is going to help you achieve your goals. That's number one. And number two, having a plan dictates what kind of investments you should make, how much you should have in fixed income. Do you need an immediate annuity as, a pension alternative? How much should you have in stocks? Rather than finding yourself in an unpredictable situation, as Dick Gregerson talked about, sometimes out of the blue, you're running a business and somebody comes with you with an offer. Or, even worse, something happens on the health situation and all of a sudden you find yourself as a surviving spouse, what to do with the business. And that's why I can't overemphasize on this program. You want to be successful in business or in retirement, you need to have a plan. It all begins with that, And it's that simple. I'm Jim Poplava. On behalf of myself and Kathleen Harris, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.